From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a concert of music inspired by the new tango, featuring a trio of bandoneon, piano, and violin, led by composer Evan Lurie. Also today, an idiosyncratic review of 1990 from political cartoonist Mark Allen Stamaty, the creator of the syndicated strip Washington. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead runs down his choices for the year's best jazz releases. And we continue our series in which we ask our critics to talk about something outside of their regular beat. Today, book critic John Leonard tells us about one of his favorite dishes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The State Department and the Israeli Embassy in Washington are disputing an Israeli newspaper report that Secretary of State James Baker probably would go to Baghdad on January 9th to see Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. State Department officials said there's no progress on trying to arrange the visit. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
Joseph Wilson, the American diplomat in charge of the U.S. Embassy, either telephones or visits the Iraqi Foreign Ministry in Baghdad every day. He called again today, and State Department officials said later there's no movement in trying to make arrangements for a visit by Secretary of State James Baker. Time for such a trip is running out. Baker said the latest he would go to Baghdad to see President Saddam Hussein was January 3rd, and White House spokesman Don Davidson said there's been no change in that date. The Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv quoted unidentified Israeli diplomats in its report that Baker probably would be in Baghdad on January 9th. But at the Israeli embassy in Washington, spokeswoman Ruth Yaron said she had no idea how the report originated and that it was pure speculation. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The State Department has asked all non-essential personnel and dependents of U.S. government workers to leave Jordan and Sudan before January 15th. The department noted that there's strong support for Iraq in both countries and recommended that U.S. citizens stay away. The government said that pro-Iraqi sentiment could be directed against Americans. British author Salman Rushdie's attempts at reconciliation with Muslims offended by his novel The Satanic Verses were rebuffed today. Iran's spiritual leader said the death sentence on Rushdie is irreversible. Jim Muir of the BBC has more.
In a statement issued by his office and broadcast on Tehran Radio, Ayatollah Khamenei said that what he called the verdict of Islam would remain unchanged, even if Mr. Rushdie were to repent and become the most pious Muslim of his time. The Ayatollah dismissed Mr. Rushdie's recent statement as futile, saying it had been made with the help of pseudo-Muslims. Indeed, Mr. Khamenei said, Salman Rushdie's attempt at repentance showed that the fatwa against him and the commitment of Muslims to carrying it out were bearing fruit. No one would now dare to offend the sacred values of Islam or its prophet, he said. If Mr. Rushdie had hoped that his statement would be enough to persuade Iranian leaders to rescind the fatwa, he would clearly be disappointed. Ayatollah Khamenei inherited the mantle of supreme spiritual guide of the Iranian revolution when the Imam Khomeini died in June last year.
Jim Muir of the BBC. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points today to close at 2,637.13. Advances edge declines in light trading of 79 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have a concert for you of music derived from the tango, composed by pianist Evan Lurie. Lurie first became known as the pianist in the band The Lounge Lizards, which is led by his brother John Lurie, who has composed music for and starred in Jim Jarmusch's movies Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise. For the past few years, my guest Evan Lurie has been writing music for bandoneon, which is a cousin of the accordion. It's smaller than the accordion and has buttons instead of keys. Evan Lurie's second album of music for bandoneon has just been released by Island Records. His records feature a quintet, but today we'll be hearing a trio featuring Evan Lurie at the piano, Alfredo Pedernera from Buenos Aires on bandoneon, and Jill Jaffe, violin. Jill plays with John Zorn and Philip Glass and has composed for film and theater. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air, and why don't we get started with one of your pieces.
Thank you.
That was beautiful. That's a piece called The Spinster's Waltz, and it's also featured on Evan Lurie's new album. You know, Evan, anyone who knows your work with the Lounge Lizards will think, geez, what a odd juxtaposition, because you work with the Lounge Lizards. This is a band that's very ironic in a lot of the music it plays and the kind lizards. Of irreverent. The Lizards, yeah. And this music is very different from that. It's a much more kind of emotional music and a much more stately music.
Well, this is music that I found that when I realized I could really play this music, that this was really what I wanted to do, I was really afraid that, like, you can't write this kind of music, you know. You're betraying the 20th century or something like that.
Well, how did you start writing for bandoneon? It's not an instrument that you play. Not that I know of.
Yeah, no. It's a very complicated instrument. It requires some kind of suspension of logic to be able to play the thing. You know, for the pianist, it's like, piano's really logical. It's like, we read from left to right, and the piano begins, and, you know, which is actually probably an unhealthy attitude for a composer to look at things from moving from...
Linear.
From low, yeah. But it really has the piano is like...
In
logic
a line,
personified.
All in a line, yeah.
But the bandoneon, the buttons, I've never been able to figure out under what system they were possibly set up. There must be some system, but it just fit with the, you can see why it fit with the tango immediately. It was like this surreal box with this bizarre system of placing the buttons.
Well, Evan, let me ask you to introduce another of your compositions.
This next tune is called Terraces, from a sense memory of Baba Niko's Terrace in Rome. Thank you.
That was Evan Lurie's composition, Terraces. And by the way, several of the pieces that we're hearing performed today on Fresh Air by a trio are featured in a quintet variation on Evan Lurie's new album, Selling Water by the Side of the River, which has just come out on Island Records. I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to more music composed by Evan Lurie for his quintet, performed for us today by a trio of bandoneon, violin, and piano. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a concert today of music composed by my guest pianist Evan Lurie, and he's featured on piano. We have Jill Jaffe on violin and Alfredo Pedernera on bandoneon. Evan, I have to ask you, when you realized you were really interested in bandoneon and wanted to write for it, did you have anyone in mind? Did you know anyone who played the instrument who you could write for and play with?
Oh, yeah, lots of people. No, and it was a whole story about... I didn't even know what the thing looked like when I first heard it. I had no idea of its capabilities or whether... You know, can you play two notes at once? Can you play five notes at once? What's the range? What's the lowest note? What's the highest note? Is this possible? Is that possible? Is it possible to essentially play one rhythm in one hand and another rhythm in the other? No, none of this was... And I found a bandoneon player in New York who was Japanese, who just played very literally, you know. Actually, the next song we're going to do has a little section in it where it's just the bandoneon alone for I think it's like one bar or something. And, of course, on the page it's written, da-da-da-da-da-da. And this guy, this Japanese player, who played it very literally, he looked at the page, he played it, you know. And I thought, oh, boy, this writing is all wrong. I don't know what I've done wrong. But there was a carpenter working down the hall, Argentinian, who heard the bandoneon. So he came. He said, oh, you're working with a bandoneon player. He said, you have to meet my friend. He's a singer of tango. So he brings his... So I find the Japanese guy who is heard by the carpenter, who 10 days later brings by this friend of his who's a singer. And we do some of the singer's pieces, and just myself and Roy Nathanson was there, too. And we play these things, and I play some of my compositions, and this Martin says, do you have a bandoneon player? And I said, well, you know, rather proud that I had indeed found a bandoneon player. And I said, yes, I'm working with this Japanese guy, and he says, oh, no, for this music, again, you know, cultural imperialism and all the rest, he says, for this music, you must have an Argentine bandoneon player. You have to meet Fredo. And then, so another 2 weeks go by, and Martin brings Fredo by, you know. It's like, Alfredo walks into the studio holding the bandoneon, you know. And Roy leans over to me, and he says, this is the guy, you know. But so, if you remember from the beginning of the story, the literal eighth notes, and you'll hear the way Alfredo takes them in this tune. Thank you.
That really sounded great.
Thank you.
What's the name of the piece?
Falling.
Why so called?
Oh, because... a few reasons. Because I realized I was writing myself into a real, I was writing myself into a corner. And also, I knew that for Fredo, certain things in it would be very strange for him. That they would be things that he had not come upon before. A little
in tango music, he wouldn't have come upon
yeah.
it.
And, so that was a reason to call it Folly, because it was like, do I really want to continue on this? And, you know.
I should say that Fredo, who plays bandoneon, doesn't speak much English. So is it hard for you as the composer to communicate beyond music with each
other?
Yeah,
but maybe, I mean, we never mess each other up with like, oh, you know, I had a really lousy day. We never take advantage, we cannot take advantage of each other in that way at all. He knows, I mean, he knows the story. We communicate extremely well. We just don't. We're denied the abuse of familiarity in that kind of way, you know.
Well, I think we have time for one more piece of music.
Okay. Okay. This is called Liam. Short and one at the end. Do you remember that?
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to all of you for a terrific concert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it was fun.
It's a lot of fun. Very unusual music. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to categorize. Very, very nice.
Yeah, but I think things really should be hard to categorize. You know what I mean? Because nothing is the product of a single influence.
Let me thank you again for joining us. And again, music by Evan Laurie on piano, Jill Jaffe violin, Alfredo Pettinera on bandoneon. And the two albums of music for bandoneon are Selling Water by the Side of the River and Pieces for Bandoneon, both under the name of Evan Laurie. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Evan, would you play us out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. ''1990 has been a dangerous year in the syndicated political comic strip Washington. The U.S. may soon be involved in a war in the Three Quarters East with the countries Terrania and Fanatistan. Coming up, a review of 1990 in the world of Washington from its creator, Mark Allen Stamaty. Also, our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, gives us his choices for the best jazz records of 1990. And they say you can find anything in New York City, but don't tell that to book critic John Leonard. He tells us what he had to go through just to get a decent pork chop. It's part of our series in which we ask our critics to talk about something that's not part of their regular beat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. In another sign of growing tension in the Persian Gulf crisis, the State Department today ordered the American embassies in Jordan and Sudan to evacuate all embassy dependents and non-essential personnel. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In announcing the order today, the State Department cited unstable conditions in the region caused by Iraq's failure to comply with United Nations resolutions. Jordan and Sudan have both been sympathetic to Iraq in the Gulf crisis, and American officials are clearly worried about anti-American incidents in those countries if war should break out in the Gulf. The State Department order warns American embassy dependents and non-essential personnel to leave, quote, well before January 15th. After that date, the UN Security Council has decided, Allied forces may attack Iraqi forces if they have not left Kuwait. In addition to evacuating embassy dependents and non-essential staff, the State Department today warned private American citizens not to travel to Jordan or Sudan. Americans already there were advised to leave. Any who remain behind are being told to stay in touch with the embassy and to exercise caution. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
3 weeks before a United Nations-imposed deadline for Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait or face a possible attack, an Israeli newspaper is reporting Washington and Baghdad have agreed on January 9th for high-level discussions to try to defuse the situation in the Persian Gulf. The independent daily Mahariv quotes Israeli diplomats who've been in contact with American officials, but State Department spokeswoman Sandra McCarty says there's been no agreement on talks between Secretary of State James Baker and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. An Iraqi ship carrying over 200 peace activists has been diverted in the Arabian Sea after a boarding party that included U.S. Marines scuffled with the crew and some of the women. No one was hurt. The ship was headed to the Iraqi port of Basra. From Nicosia, Mike Theodula reports.
The Iraqi-flagged vessel was boarded after it refused several requests by an Australian warship to stop so its cargo could be checked. A team of Marines, including Americans, Britons, and Australians, landed on the ship by helicopter and were challenged by some of the Iraqi crew and women passengers. They fired warning shots and exploded stun grenades, but a U.S. Navy doctor said no one was hurt. Keen to make the most of the incident, the ship's Iraqi captain claimed two women had miscarriages and another two suffered heart attacks when they saw the U.S. Marines board the vessel. But he later admitted no one needed to be hospitalized. The vessel was found to be carrying sugar, cooking oil, and other items outlawed by the UN sanctions against Iraq. The ship's now being escorted to an unidentified port. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed with healthy gains, but volume remained very light. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the day with a gain of 15.84. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Congressman Bob Forehead and his creator, Washington cartoonist Mark Allen Stamity. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has his picks of the 10 best albums of 1990, but before he shares it, he has a few disclaimers.
In 1990, there were a lot of very good jazz records, but few great ones. So be advised that if I made up my 10 best list a week from now, it might be a little different. I'm also skeptical of lists that are loaded with recent releases. There are a couple of new albums I like which I didn't include because I haven't lived with them long enough to know if they'll hold up. I'll review them for you soon. And although in any given year a lot of the best jazz comes out on obscure labels, I've limited myself to albums that should be fairly easy to find. So, anyway, in no particular order, here's my top 10. The best jazz album of 1990 was actually a series of three records by pianist Randy Weston. On Portraits of Duke Ellington and Portraits of Thelonious Monk, he plays music by those composers. On Self-Portraits, he performs his own stuff. Weston's lean and percussive style owes a lot to Ellington and Monk, but also to the years he spent living in Africa. He makes the piano ring out like a West African drum choir. These records sound great on first listening and stand up to repeated exposure. There's also a Randy Weston tune on the year's best vocal album, Abby Lincoln's The World Is Falling Down. She's a classic example of a singer with a limited range and a harsh vocal quality who can really put over a song.
People walking around, living in a daze, high above the ground with their snooty ways, putting people down, acting phony while they fly.
Hi. 1990 was a year when jazz began turning back to composers for guidance. The best writer for big band nowadays is Muhal Richard Abrams, who knows the history of the music as well as any young bebopper you read about in Time magazine, but who recombines elements from the past in his own ingenious way. His latest album is called The Haringa Suite. Another fine big band album, the New York Composers Orchestra, that's the name of the band and the CD, featured diverse compositions by four younger writers, including Wayne Horvitz and Robin Holcomb. The quintet album, Wide Open Spaces, by bassist Michael Formanek, was the most smartly orchestrated small group album this year. It's not just that Formanek gets a wide range of colors out of a unit that contains alto sax and violin, but that he keeps his pieces admirably short. This music's concentrated. As far as traditional small group jazz goes, two of my favorites were by tenor saxophonists. Billy Pierce's trio album, Equilateral, avoided sounding like just another good mainstream date because his band had no bass player. That made pianist Hank Jones and drummer Roy Haynes work that much harder. And cool jazz veteran Stan Getz came out with a live album called Anniversary, which showed how beautiful his sound remains. Great band, too. Pianist Lenny Tristano was another instigator of cerebral cool jazz in the 1950s. But saxophonist Anthony Braxton's album, 8 plus 3 Tristano Compositions, 1989, turns everything Tristano stood for on its head. Most of it is fast, hot, and messy. The album should have been a disaster, but it works. It's all the more noteworthy because Braxton's supposed to be reserved and cool himself. On the reissue front, 1990 saw the usual barrage of great box sets, but my last votes go to two neglected re-releases. The first is called New York Sessions, recorded in 1961 by the late English tenor saxophonist Tubby Hayes. If you like classic Sonny Rollins, check this guy out. Composer Anthony Davis's album Hemispheres didn't get much attention when it came out in 1983 or when it was reissued early this year. But it was one of the most ingenious large group records of the last decade. Just as Randy Weston uses his piano like an African drum choir, Anthony Davis uses his orchestra like one. Hemispheres is minimalism for jazz fans. Okay, that makes 10, and I'm out of time.
Given Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence, if you want to get a copy of his 10 best list, send us a note with a self-addressed stamped envelope. Our address is Fresh Air, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is Fresh Air. In the world of Washington, where the political process is getting to be one big joke, it's the mission of Congressman Bob Forehead to maintain the appearance of substance. It was Bob Forehead's first ambition to become a TV game show host, but with the help of charismaticians, the support of the tycoon sector, a JFK haircut, and convincing buzzwords, Forehead has become an important player in Congress. Forehead is the creation of Mark Allen Stamaty, whose syndicated political cartoon strip, Washington, is published in The Village Voice, The Washington Post, and 35 other papers. We asked Stamaty to review the year 1990 in the world of Washington. As readers of Washington know, war is about to break out in the region between the Middle East and the Far East, the region known as the Three Quarters East. You see, with the decline of manufacturing in the United States, America has been moving towards a sneaker-based economy. And essential raw materials for these high-tech sneakers are found in the three-quarter east countries of Turania and Fanatistan.
This sneaker relies on a computer chip that particularly functions in a sneaker, in the particular environment of a sneaker, and is the right size and is flexible, etc. And it's made out of a certain kind of sand. And the only place in the world where they have this sand is in the desert of Fanatistan. So King Fanaticus of Fanatistan is starting to make deals with the pretense company that developed the sneaker, and at the same time, the leader of Tyrania, Colonel Lanoyu, is jealous of this desert now, and so he wants to basically grab the desert. what occurs is that the United States finds itself in a position where they've been friends and enemies of the various dictators in the region of the Three Quarters East over a period of time. Now what's happened is they want to pursue a balanced policy, which is because they want to end up on the winning side of this war, because the U.S. economy depends on it, and therefore they're basically going to send troops to both sides. They're going to send military support to both sides of the war, which means that at some point U.S. troops might be fighting each other, which they're not sure if the American people will support a war where U.S. troops fight each other for the purpose of sneakers.
Now, where does Congressman Bob Forehead stand on the issue of war?
Basically, he wants to come out a winner, too. So he basically makes emphatic, angry, vague statements with with always mentioning that he has some reservations, which he doesn't want to enunciate because he doesn't want to, interfere with the administration's policy. Therefore, if the war turns out to be successful, he can point to his passionate anger, in favor of the war effort, but supporting the administration vaguely. If he and if they lose, he can say, now I can tell you what my reservations were, and he can use all his Monday morning quarterbacking as plug him into his reservations.
From reading Washington, it seems to me you're amused by how slowly it became acceptable to raise the subject of the SNL crisis. Politicians used to consider it an issue too boring to even consider bringing up.
Yeah, I think, there's a funny thing about democracy and self-government. It's one thing is that there is this basic sort of problem, which is that it seems like our economy is at the bottom of an awful lot of troubles. Our economy, everybody's economy, and it also is, they always say people vote their pocketbook. At the same time, the real nuts and bolts of what it's about, like the nuts and bolts of the emerging SNL crisis, the nuts and bolts of the budget problems, of Social Security, all these things, most people can't crunch the numbers. Most people can't understand the math. And when they call it self-government, the actual math of the thing and the thing is so vastly complex, and that critical issue is now really beginning to hit us, and even when people said for years it was going to hit us, but in the campaigns of 84 and 88, you couldn't get anybody to really deal with the issue of the budget deficit and go ahead.
How are your characters in Washington trying to exploit the SNL crisis to their own advantage?
I'm not sure if the SNL crisis has been exploited. I mean, but Bob Forehead has had for a long time the deficit denial amendment, which was his solution basically is to just deny that it exists, and nobody could tell anyway, really. But he hasn't been able to get far enough with that. But I think that could really sell, and that could really make him a national figure.
Yeah, it sounds good. That sounds good. Now, one powerful senator in your strip has been trying to crack down on homoerotic imagery. What's one of the things he hit on this year?
What happened was that the Hubble telescope was sent up into space, and it was taking photographs that because they had a problem with the lens, it didn't. The images weren't clear, and they were, and a lot of these photographs of space were kind of useless to the to NASA. However, there was a museum in Washington that thought they were rather lovely, and so they put these photos of these stars on view. But there was a senator in Washington that went to the exhibit and found that they contained suggestions of homoerotic imagery. So he was threatening to cancel the space program.
More than any other political cartoon I can think of, your comic criticizes not just the rotten apples and the bad decisions, but the whole political system and all of Washington political culture.
Yeah, I was invited to do this. I mean, I was doing a comic strip in the Village Voice, and I got a call from Meg Greenfield, who's the editorial op-ed page editor of the Washington Post. And I think one reason she might have done that is because I have a certain... Because my view of the world and the world I was in was very different in a certain way, and And so there's a certain basic aversion. It's a fascination and aversion that I have to the way the whole place runs. I mean, one thing is it's exceedingly pragmatic, which is interesting and disturbing at the same time. And there's a kind of a cold, sterile, pragmatic quality to Washington where they, for instance, I mean, I had a cartoon about a cocktail party where it's the guy goes around and says, you know, how do you do? What are you? And the person is tells him what job they are in, and if he doesn't offer him enough networking advantage, you know, professionally, then he would toss him over his shoulder, you know, thanks, but I don't need you. And he'd toss him over his shoulder, and then another one, he'd toss him over his shoulder, and then until he gets to somebody who's connected, and then, you know, this is the jackpot, so there's a certain way that people aren't people down there, and that it's very troubling and fascinating at the same time.
You're still living in New York, right?
Yes.
How much time do you spend in Washington? How often do you feel like you have to go down there to, like, witness firsthand what happens in Washington political life?
Well, in the beginning, I went down. I was down there 3 or 4 days a week, every other week, every week. Sometimes I was down there, you know, sometimes a week at a time or something. I spent a lot of time there because I wanted to feel the vibration of the city, really, because I'd spent a lot of time in New York and I knew what New York felt like, and I felt it viscerally, and I wanted to feel Washington viscerally. So in the early years, I spent a tremendous amount of time there. Now I go down, I'd say periodically, which is maybe once every couple of months or something, because I don't feel like I have to be there as much, because basically now when I hear the news and when I read the papers, I know what it feels like down there. I know how it feels to sit in a hearing room of Congress. I know how it feels to sit in the White House. I know how it feels to be around journalists and the pack of journalists. I know how all the things feel, so I can apply that ongoing, you know, environment that I've internalized to whatever is occurring. So it's not as necessary as it was previously.
Well, here's something about you that I think most of your readers won't know. On your resume, which is, by the way, handwritten, you write 1956 to present, occasional Elvis Presley impersonator.
Yeah.
Now, that appeared a little more formally in Who's Who, where it said avocation : impersonating Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
So what's the story?
Let's see. Well, you want me to hum a few bars? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. Well, tell me if, I don't know if this is going to sound right. What happened was I was a nut of an Elvis Presley fan when I was a kid. And then later on, one time I was at a party about 12 years ago and some people had some guitars and I picked up on it again. And I do it now periodically. I do it every so often. I have a gold suit, you know, a gold jacket and everything. And I don't know if it'll sound right on the radio, but I could try to do some if you want to try to do it.
Oh, please,
yeah. I'll try a little bit of maybe one, like, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I met you like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friend said I'm acting queer as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Hey, I'm all shook up. Does that sound right? I mean, if it sounds bad, I...
You know, oh, no, that's terrific. This is the last thing I was expecting. That's really good. Yeah. You did it with real heart.
Yeah, but if it was really off key...
No.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
I thought you were good.
Oh, good.
Have you been in any of those contests?
I've never... No. Oh, you know, one time I had worked all night on my deadline, and somebody had told me there's this Elvis audition in Times Square somewhere, and like... I was up all night, and after I delivered my deadline, I ran up there, and I went on this thing, and I tried out for this whatever it was, but I didn't get the part. But I don't know what my, you know, in the amongst the you know, half a million Elvis Presley or more Elvis Presley imitators in the world, I don't know what my standing would be. So.
Mark Allen Stamaty is the creator of the political cartoon strip Washington, and someday I hope to see him in his gold lamé jacket. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll have a report on Turkey and the crisis in the Persian Gulf. Producer Peter Breslow and I know we're in Turkey for a couple of weeks this month, and we'll be reporting on the very serious economic impact that the sanctions against Iraq have had on the Turks, and we'll also hear about the political debate, some of it that's happened in Turkey over the crisis. Also, a talk with Saul Linowitz, who negotiated the Panama Canal Treaty and was at one time U.S. mediator in the Middle East, on the prospects for diplomacy and negotiations now with Iraq. And Bob Mondello reviews Woody Allen's new movie.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, we've decided to give our critics a break from their regular beats. We turned book critic John Leonard loose on another meaty subject.
I love pork chops, and my wife is a Jewish vegetarian, and so we eat out a lot. This can be a major problem on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. The restaurants there are either very ethnic or designed for yuppies, sun-dried and extra virgin olive oil, who crouch to consume their usual minimalist bistro meal of dead cilantro leaves, medallions of warm goat cheese, and half a scallop on a bed of money. In such a neighborhood, you can usually find pork, but it seldom looks like a chop. 6 months ago, disgusted by a menu, I tried to describe the real thing, this atavism of my proletarian Irish Catholic childhood, to the kitchen staff at the Hudson Bay Inn on East 76th Street. I might as well have been talking in Quechua or Linear B. I suddenly found myself sympathizing with restaurant critics. For a living, I review books and television. You'll get around to looking at the books and the TV programs I've recommended and decide for yourself soon enough whether or not I'm a jerk. But you'll never know what I really ate. A restaurant critic has a harder time than the rest of us. The edible is unspeakable. There's nothing to quote. And it's sort of Heraclitian. You can't step twice into the same fettuccine. To the chef at Hudson Bay, I quoted from a Wall Street Journal story on the National Pork Producers Council and its new $7 million ad campaign to promote pork as the other white meat. I mentioned their annual Pork Queen contest. But nobody's been interested in the politics of pork since the Great Indian Mutiny of 1857. Certainly not this chef. And so I talked about the pig in history and literature, the sociology and anthropology of pork. Pigs were sacred in ancient Crete because a sow suckled Jupiter. Almost all we know about the Eleusinian mysteries is that pork fat was fried in the sacrificial fires. Throughout antiquity, to talk to Venus, you stuck a pig. That pork is still unclean for at least two religions, even after we figured out how to zap it with X-rays from an electron beam and kill the perfidious Trichina nematode, is probably because of the devil's claw marks on every piggy foreleg. In broad-minded China, that hog heaven, they gave the beast a year of its own on their crazy calendar. In Henry IV, Doll Tearsheet called Falstaff, "Thou whoreson little tidy Bartholomew boar pig." The poet Rilke wrote a long letter to his mother on Westphalian ham. Gunter Grass wrote an entire novel, Headbirths, about pork sausage. Think of Orwell and Miss Piggy, not to mention Francis Bacon, or Adam and Eve and the first spare rib. In Pokes and Clover, three little pig heads, pigtails, pigskins, piggy banks, pork pie hats, pork belly futures, pork barrel politics, and Gadarene swine. By the time I got around to describing the suckling pig I once roasted at a pond in New England for a mob of deadbeat artists from the McDowell colony who accused me of infanticide, the chef shut me up. "This isn't food criticism," he said. "It's Freudian analysis." So I went next door to Gristidi's, bought a couple of chops, and showed him how. They have to be at least an inch thick, so when they're broiled, the outside's black and the inside leaks. No sauce and no parsley. Just a hot potato, a cold knife, lots of salt, and a barmaid. One of those out-of-work actresses who are always waiting around at Hudson Bay for their agents to call about an audition for, of course, Ophelia in Shakespeare's Hamlet.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sherrock, and Seuss Bolin. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Frears, director of My Beautiful Laundrette, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, Dangerous Liaisons, and the new film, The Grifters. And we talk with Village Voice photographer Sylvia Plahey about taking pictures on the street. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.